And I remember Gyps coming in with five or six or 10 revolutionaries dead and chucked into the morgue in the hospital. And they're leaving, all the soldiers singing, no, about our country and let's clean up the country from this dirt and things like that. Very happy. Happy is the right word. Motivated to get more of these people. And all of that is about ideology.
Welcome to The Political Animals. I'm your host, Jonathan Cole. I'm Assistant Director of Research at the Australian Centre for Christianity and Culture at Charles Sturt University, and I'm a scholar of political theology, the intersection of religion and politics. I'm joined by a very special guest for this episode called Dr. Carlos Raimundo. Now, Carlos has one of the longest, most diverse, and for those reasons, very interesting CV. So it's going to take a little bit of time just to run through the highlights, but the highlights are important because they will foreshadow some of the things that we're going to discuss. Now, Carlos is from Argentina, and he originally trained as a doctor and surgeon. And as we'll learn through the course of this conversation, found himself working in some pretty incredible and horrific circumstances. Not being satisfied with surgery, which is not an easy thing to qualify for, he branched out into psychiatry, philosophy, theology, and psychodrama. Now, I've got no idea what psychodrama is, but I suspect we might discover in the course of the conversation what that's all about. Just while we're on the topic of theology, he studied under a very obscure, little-known figure by the name of Francis Schaeffer in Le Brie in Switzerland. Of course, I'm being facetious. He studied under one of the giants of 20th century theology. He got involved in liberation theology during the military dictatorship in Argentina, and maybe we'll learn something about that because that could be fascinating. Now, that's just the first 36 years of Carlos's life while he lived in Argentina. In 1986, he moved to Australia to become a Baptist pastor to Spanish-speaking churches or the Spanish-speaking community in Western Sydney. He has worked as a psychotherapist in both Argentina and Australia, and he developed an award-winning technology. I suspect this has something to do with the psychodrama, called Play of Life, which, this is the description, it's a 3D simulation method to enhance insight and behavioral modification. He currently works as a therapist, coach, and trainer on leadership, culture, and personal growth in both the corporate sector and in for religious orders or churches nationally, as in Australia, and also internationally. And if that weren't enough, his current research is in the area of neuroscience, where he is looking at emotions, behavioral modification, and relationships. Carlos, I've never had a guest with a CV like that. It's a real pleasure to welcome you to The Political Animals.
Thank you very much.
Carlos, let's begin with Argentina. Now, I mentioned that you spent the first 36 years of your life there. One of the big focuses of this podcast, of course, as the name suggests, is politics. And as I understand it, every year of your life in Argentina was spent in some pretty politically turbulent times. And you have a very visceral firsthand experience of political violence. But before we get to that, can you tell us something, just so we've got to assume some and maybe many listeners won't know much about Argentina's history. So can you tell us a little bit about the Argentina you were born in?
Okay. Just to go a little bit before I was born, Argentina was at the time, or before that, one of the richest countries in the world, just because of the political situation and also agronomy and the possibilities. It was called the silo of the world. Now they was feeding the world. And then through different political situations, is now, no, as we speak, one of the bottom in the line. So this is talking about politics, that is your field, is just a case study in itself, no, how Argentina has worked out how it is. And I don't know if this is relevant, but I heard one anthropologist when they signed that South America or the Spanish part and Portuguese part of Americas were colonized to take from it. So the people that went there and the politicians and the people in government, the only focus was, what can I take from it? Very different to the other migration, especially in North America, no, that were there for political and religious freedom. So the idea was, how can we live life better here, no, in freedom and equality? So in Argentina, what I heard more, and I think it makes sense, is that the government point is not what I can give for, what can I give, what can I do for you, but what can I take? So that creates almost a DNA, in my point of view. I'm not a politician, and I don't know who I am with all my CV, no idea who I am anyway. But so when I talk, I don't know. That gives a little bit of a DNA of the countries around there. And if you just browse what is happening now as we speak, it's exactly the same, no? So it's not changing. And it's interesting that Moreno, the creator of psychodrama, talks about cultural conserve. That is a conserve, it's a culture that becomes like a conserve, like a can of conserve, and doesn't change until we act in a way that we can change that culture individually, as a family, a society. So the Argentina where I was born was under the presidency of Perón, Juan Domingo Perón.
Which era was this? I won't ask you to say exactly what
52,
year.
52. Okay. I was born in 52.
Okay.
And at that year, he was in the second presidency of Perón, and his wife is the more known internationally, that is called Eva Perón.
Thanks to Madonna.
Exactly. So Madonna, it's the Madonna of Argentina, Evita, no, so popular. Don't cry for me, Argentina. Beautiful.
But you know, it's funny, anyway. Carlos, because I think that movie came out in the 90s, if my memory serves.
Yes, I think so.
And I was newly married, and my wife was really into that soundtrack. And it's not really my cup of tea, but I think I could almost sing the entire
collection
of songs. And it's funny the way Hollywood can popularize something. So I know nothing about Argentinian history except Eva Perón, thanks to Madonna playing her in the movie. I can't even remember the movie, but that's the one famous personality from Argentinian politics. I guess the Falkland War is the other one, and we might get into that later.
There are three things in Argentina that are, and then I'll come back to your question, that are very popular. One is Evita or Eva Perón, Che Guevara, no, and the Falklands. No, this is our forex sport things that we have. So we can come back to Che Guevara later, because part of the story too. So when I was born, it was at the end of the Perón government, when Perón got the government, they got into power. It was in a chaotic place in Argentina. When he got into power, they say that there was so much money in the country that at that time the treasury of the country was based on the amount of gold you had. It's not the currency at the moment, but at that time it's the amount of gold. And what they say, I don't know how true is that or not, if there's a metaphor of truth, that there was so much gold in the treasury that the gold was in the corridors.
Oh, really?
and it could be close to what it was. So Perón goes to power with a lot of money. And of course, Perón is at the moment, from that time till now, one of the more controversial person that creates this duality in Argentina, or you are a Peronist or you are not. It's a dualistic thinking. And the government now is a Peronist government at the moment. And
was still, that? So can I just ask, Carlos? Would that government be considered on the left?
It's an interesting question. The intention is to the left. No, this is the intention. But in my point of view, and I'm not a politician, so I can be wrong in these things. From my point of view, it's also a fascist view. That for many people, the story or the narrative of that political sense is, I'm here to provide to you. But in reality, it works in a way that a people feeds the government. So this is a very interesting dynamic where the poverty grows and grows and grows.
And so this goes to your earlier point about the political DNA of Argentina.
Of South America, so yeah.
The Peronist government, it sounds, from your perspective, is just as rapacious and sort of taking from the people as any other government. But of course, its public narrative is the opposite. That it's...
Well, it was a very, very rich country at that time. So the money was there to give. So for whatever reasons, the many people in the country, at least more than 50%, were unhappy. And the government took over. I think it was close to one of my birthdays, around 52. So he was, through a military coup, he was taken off the government, and he has to escape to an exile to Spain. And from then on, I grew up in mostly military governments.
So hang on, just so I get this right. So in 1952.
Yep.
A military coup occurs that gets rid of Perón.
Yes.
And he flees to Spain.
Spain.
And then for the rest of your years in Argentina, you're living under some form of military.
The majority of the times were military governments and coups. So there was a joke saying is how to become a president of Argentina. Well, just go into the military and become a general, so then you become a president. No, there was the career path, no, to become a president. Yeah.
So that was next step after general was president.
But it was president. So this is what I grew up with. But I don't know how relevant is this. I grew up also in a family where my father and my grandfather and their family were philosophical atheists, following a politician called Palacios. That was a socialist. It's not a communist, it was a socialist and highly intellectual movement. So my father and my grandfather grew up with that Palacios story, that is a socialist and totally opposed to that, but also opposed to the government. No, because in Argentina, and the church. So in Argentina, so I grew up with that. No, the Catholic Church in Argentina was always allied to the government and to military. So military and government, a general and a bishop, or a general and archbishop, they are together like a dance, not like a tango. They're always together. So I grew up hearing my grandfather or my father, when hearing the radio, at the time was not television, something about that they were in a meeting, a bishop or a cardinal and the military. I hear my grandfather and father screaming, fuera, 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 like, go out. Get away. So I grew up with that animosity towards religion and military. But then going to school in the morning, we need to sing to the flag every morning. And I will remember sitting there looking at the flag. I said, this is the most ridiculous thing we can have, singing to the flag. So the country became very nationalistic, now the best of the world.
Was that the main ideology of these military governments?
Yes.
Like, if you're going to categorize it, were they, I guess conventionally most political scientists would say they were right wing. Generally, you don't get left-wing military coups and dictatorships, interestingly, but that's a separate question.
Yeah,
but
it's a different...
So is it right-wing nationalism? Is that
It was a right-wing nationalist. It was a right-wing nationalist. What I found later on that we can come back on another time is that I grew up in a country where life was against something. You know, was against Perón, was against this, was against that, was not towards anything.
This is what I was finding out.
I couldn't articulate it at that time. But it's like, we are fighting the whole time, always against something. And at that time was in Argentina. But something interesting about Argentina, that people who have seen the movie The Two Popes, there's a joke that Pope Francis, this is called Bergoglio in that movie. He asked Benedict, do you know how an Argentinian commit suicide? And the person said, no, I don't know. So so Bergoglio answer, the Argentinian goes to the top of his ego and jumps.
Oh, that's pretty funny.
So this is a joke from the Pope. And he has said that joke in several interviews to show that the Argentina, not Argentina, but more Buenos Aires, no, the Buenos Aires culture is very arrogant in itself, no, because of historical reasons.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. So, Carlos, why don't we go now to your, I don't know how else to say this, your personal involvement, not an involvement you chose, but that period in your life when you got drawn into the dirty war, I think is what it's known as. Can you talk us through the circumstances you found yourself in?
So in a nutshell, Perón goes to the exile, and then after many military governments, he comes back. He comes back with a new wife, Isabel, he became a president again through different processes. Then he died, and Isabelita, no, becomes the president of Argentina. And he has beside her, López de la Rega was a person who was like her right hand, and they become a very right-wing government, no? Very right-wing government. Simultaneously with that, the revolution and the Peronists who were socialists start growing and growing, no? With the different communist lines, maybe a Trotskyist line, a more Leninist line, Stalin line, different ways of thinking that created different ways to attack the government through a revolutionary and guerrilla movement.
So, using violence as a
exactly revolutionary as a voice. Tool. No, the voice was violence. So I started university in the 70s. I forgot the year. I think 72 was the revolution. So I started. I remember one day I was in a class in medicine. And a person with a hood came into five people or around that come with a hood into the classroom with machine guns. And they said to the professor, you out.
Oh, really?
Like that.
You're in the middle of a class.
In the middle of a class, like university. So they come in all in black and they said, I said to the professor, you out. We got around 3-4 minutes of propaganda.
Oh, from the
from the guerrilla.
Want to get a little lecture in Marxism?
Exactly, and the majority of the people, like this, and then they left.
Hang on, so the majority of the students are cheering.
Yeah, they're cheering, and many paralyzed for the fear because it's so unsettling, and they went, and there were many people disappearing, kidnapped for money. So they become a totally unsettled situation, unruled country.
Can I just ask a couple of questions? One, what happened to that class? Did the professor come back?
The professor didn't come back. So it was a very unsettled year.
Unless that was the last time you saw that professor.
Exactly. No, he will come back on the next week.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, of course. Oh, yeah, no, he will come back.
Because do you think was it more to interrupt the class to kind of announce that the revolution is happening?
Absolutely. Any opportunity that they could have a voice, they will find the voice. So that becomes so unruly, and financially the country became very bad. So it was a lot of strikes and until the government with Videla and the junta, they said they took over.
Okay, one other question for clarification for the sake of listeners, because in this period of Argentina's history with this political tumult, it always gets very confusing and almost convoluted. Were these guerrillas pro-government or anti-government?
Totally anti-government.
Okay.
Totally anti-government, and the majority with a socialist communist agenda, and many of them were supported financially, or from Cuba or from Soviet Union. And then the right wing of the government, especially the military government, was supported by the US. Mm-hmm. So a lot of money was coming in, to support that from a...
So there's an element in which this is one of the many proxy wars around of the Cold War in Latin America, Africa, and...
Absolutely. Even a Christian radio or Christian broadcast put a lot of had to get money to smuggle Bible, for example, in Cuba or things like that. So they got in the US so much money, and a lot of that money went to revolutionaries. Sorry, went to the government. It went to fight the government.
Okay.
The revolutionaries. But it's important also to know that it was not happening just in Argentina. 2-3 years before, there was Pinochet who led the revolution in Chile. So Argentina was 2-3 behind Chile, and the same story was there. And also in Brazil, and also in Uruguay, and in Paraguay. So all the countries, our neighbor's country, were facing the same thing, the same military forceful attack to the guerrilla in that way, where their system was to eradicate, of course, to win the war, but through kidnapping the missing people, and especially the torture.
Just one final question before we move on, because there's something very perplexing to someone like me who's lived their whole life in the sort of safe, peaceful waters of Australia about that experience you had at the university. Because, we've got our left-wing crazies at university. They've been there really, I guess, since the 60s in Australia, as you get right across Western universities. But masked gunmen coming in and evicting a lecturer in the middle of a lecture, and then giving a propagandistic talk is next level, and particularly when they're anti-government. And so the question I'm trying to wrap my head around is, what on earth is going on with the regime when the environment is that permissible for the rebels? Is that just symptomatic of how brazen and confident and how much support the left-wing revolutionaries had, or was the government just not in control of security at that stage? I mean, how does that even happen?
A lot of that happened before the military coup.
Okay.
But before that, this is why the military coup came, because of the government was out of control.
Got it.
So then it continued in a different way, more in an aggressive way, mm-hmm. No, not in that open way, because the universities and all the places were with the custody for the military. So we're military everywhere. And I forgot how is the word in English, but it's called interventor. The military will put a director of the university will be a military.
Oh, really?
Yeah. The person who gave me my medical certificate was a military person.
Oh, really?
A photo that I broke, I destroyed because I couldn't accept. It was terrible.
You know, the interesting thing about that, Carlos, if I may just interject momentarily, is they're both examples of left-wing and right-wing political / ideological interference in the university process, even though it's a different kind of interference. So you've got the classic left-wing revolutionaries disrupting the lecture, asserting their power and dominance over the actual lecturer. And in the other one, you've got, you've got the military inserting themselves into the bureaucracy and administration of the university as a way, presumably, of monitoring and controlling and disciplining what the lecturers are doing. Is that a fair summation?
Absolutely. You live with a total fear of what you do in one way or another, because if you are polarized and it's not a win situation. I mean, what we are seeing in Myanmar now is almost a copy of what mm-hmm. we are here, no, from the news there. And when I hear that, I know that. No, it's something we live, you don't know. So the more terrible thing was the missing people. My sister went to piano lessons and the teacher was not there anymore, disappeared. And it was a little town like Lura, for example, in the Blue Mountains. And that we lived there, a very tiny, peaceful country town. And then we went to the butcher and the butcher was disappeared. So, and it was very common. But the issue was it was very quiet. Nobody would say anything because of the fear if you're against or towards that point. And the message was, if that happened to her, she may have done something. No, so this is...
So this is under the right-wing military.
Yeah, absolutely.
So you're living in a society, even outside of Buenos Aires or the big urban
centers, whole country,
where random people in your community and social circle literally just disappear. And what do you ever hear from them again?
No. The word disappear is literal, disappeared.
Yeah.
But the person who came back are the tortured. So they are disappeared and they're tortured.
So they did come back. The disappearing is just...
They disappeared, didn't come back.
Oh, okay.
Okay, so there are many, many stories. One of them that is very well documented. They would put the revolutionaries in a plane, with concrete in the feet, and they threw it to the Rio de la Plata, that is almost into the sea. No, they chucked them, so they disappeared. So this is terrible. And then one of my best friends, that I grew up with, called Enrique. Now I'm honoring him, almost with tears in my eyes. Honoring him, that I had never seen him before, but I knew of people who saw him. He was highly tortured, and he died for other things. But the atrocity, he was in one of the cities called La Plata, it was close to Buenos Aires, and it's called La Noche de los Lápices, the Night of the Pencils, because the universities were... There was the more revolutionary people, more ideological we were, and it was, I would say we because I was there, and at the same time. And La Noche de los Lápices, or the Night of the Pencils, because of students, the military went, and I don't know how many people disappeared and were tortured. And my friend wasn't one of them.
Yeah. Now, Carlos, the extraordinary part of your experience is that Argentina has military conscription, compulsory military service, and at some point, maybe you can tell us the years, you find yourself forced to go into this, into the military that is running the country and responsible for atrocities? I mean, how does that happen?
Well, I was somehow lucky that there was a possibility at that time, because the conscription was, I think, when you were 21, then they dropped it to 18, I think. But I was studying medicine, and because of a medical student, they allowed me to finish medicine to do it as a doctor. And also because I was married, I could do it shorter. So I finished medicine. So my first work was to go to the military hospital, and I was just a doctor in the military hospital. Without any rank, of course. I was a soldier, the bottom line. And it was difficult. The things I saw there was not pretty. One, ideologically, being surrounded, my boss was a major doctor, and everybody was, of course, military. And that tension inside me. I didn't mention that my parents, when I was little, I was 4 years old, he became a Christian. No?
Oh,
A fundamental Christian.
The militant atheist.
A brethren, yeah. He became a fundamental Christian. And so I was continue hating the church and the military. He didn't change that. It changed his life in many ways, but not on that. So I grew up with that at home, and in the going to the hospital every day, and it was very difficult. I never seen torture myself, but sadly I had to deal with situations that I was seeing the effect of torture, and I was very gruesome.
And so I take it what you mean by that is you had to treat.
I had to treat people
wounds of torture
wounds
victims.
Of torture victims. So there are many stories there, but I've been investigated by intelligence many times, you know, because of my relationship with them, you know, with the tortured person. They saw that I was with a kindness different to what I should be. And
so you mean you were investigated by the Argentinian?
Absolutely, intelligence. But it was routine too. You know, it was a routine that you were under the microscope, no? Who are you, you know?
Was that a general practice, or was it because you were exposed to, you were a witness in a way to what the regime was doing? Were they particularly concerned about to make sure you were ideologically?
Absolutely, that I was. And I don't know, my answers may be naive or whatever way, it was okay. I've never had a big trouble with that, more than the tension of knowing that you're investigated. And it was hard, no? It was more than hard. And the difficulty was, yeah, you ask a question.
Oh, look, if you don't mind me asking, I'm just curious how this happens. Like, how does a torture victim get brought into the military hospital? Presumably, is it secret police or military intelligence that brings them in? Do they say anything to you, or can you just tell from the nature of the wounds? And then what happens to them after you've treated
them?
It's very
simple. I mean, didn't need to have a secret police, because there was nothing secret there.
It was open, was it?
It was open. If you watch the movie The Two Popes, you will see a lot of what I'm telling you is in that movie. And there are many movies, of course, that talks about that. But in that movie is a snapshot. It was called the Green Falcons, no? Especially in Buenos Aires, used by the military. I don't know why they were green and falcons, but they would become famous. No? If you see a green falcon going somewhere, you knew they were going to to take somebody that may never disappeared. But it was very simple. You go to the room, you ask to see a patient, and the person is chained.
Oh, so you're literally being taken to the torture chamber?
No, not to the chamber, to the hospital. In the ward.
Oh, okay.
On the ward, and like a normal hospital, but this person is okay. chained, no, with a soldier beside him with a weapon. So you don't need to ask many questions.
Sure, of course.
So who is this person? And very careful what you ask. They will never talk anyway because they don't know who you are. So they will never say anything anyway.
You mean the patient or the soldier?
The patient.
The patient's probably too scared to talk to anyone. Oh, right?
Absolutely. They don't know who I am. I'm a doctor, but they don't know. First, they don't know if I'm really a doctor or not because I'm anybody can put a white overcoat. The biggest difficulty that I had there was one day, very early in the morning, they threw into the floor a woman full of mud, very dirty, quadriplegic, with a bullet in her back. And I said, "Wow, what happened?" No, and the military person was kicking her, say, "You shut up, steady." And so I opposed to him, no, even though he didn't know I was a soldier. Mm-hmm. No, if not, I will disappear, I think. He thought I was just a civilian doctor in the hospital. So step out, and I pushed the person out. And then I asked, "Where did this happen?" I said, "That happened in Villa Maria. Villa Maria is where my mother was born, in a city." I said, "Oh." And she gave me the name of that person. The name of that person for that age, that was my age, now same age, and I knew she was the daughter of a very good friend of my father.
Wow.
A theologian and from that city, very well known. So I can imagine my heart. Now, so I care for her in a more special way. She never opened her mouth. I told her what I was, but she didn't, she can't believe, he couldn't trust me.
Mm, yeah.
You know, but this was the more difficult time. But the more difficult time was that when I went to my friends from outside the church, but when I went to the church and I tried to share that massive, I was 24, this massive situation, the silence. And I said, "Wow." So that was something I will never forget.
No. So do you mean that you sort of were looking for some pastoral care and Absolutely. Were sharing
how do you do
what you're seeing?
And, how do I do with this?
And you're just met with silence. Was that
absolute was that silence?
Fear of getting involved in Absolutely. What was happening?
Absolutely. So I faced there, what I learned later on, I didn't know at that time, the role of the church in Germany with the Nazis, with Hitler. So when I learned that, I said, "Wow, this is what happened in many places." But I felt it personally and also institutionally. So at that time, the church was continue blessing the Cardinal Prima Testa, I remember his name, blessing the weapons of the military. And in the two popes, you see that dynamic. And the sad story of two Jesuit priests that disappeared. And they reappeared again, so they come back again. And there was a very sad story for Pope Francis. You know? So this is interesting, the concept of ideology, no?
Yeah, and Carlos, I also understand that you are treating not just torture victims, but soldiers and revolutionaries who are getting injured in conflict. So you're effectively a sort of trauma surgeon or doctor in a war, treating war wounds, if I've got that right. How long were you subjected to this experience? How long?
It was like a very intense, maybe 6 months, very intense. And after that, in my private practice.
Yeah. Oh, so did you then go on to...
As a therapist, then you have people that refer you people, and then you're hard. I remember one person in Buenos Aires. I was already in Buenos Aires. I was a therapist. And this person came, and I misunderstood him. I think I didn't want to hear what he was saying. He said, what I heard is, I used to be a torturer, and I'm very uncomfortable with that, and I want to deal with that. So I heard I was a torturer, and I want to deal with that. So in my mind, I said, I don't know if I can do this. But in my fighting in my mind, but I cannot judge him. He, whatever he did, now he's, but I heard it wrong. He still was a torturer. No, he was a torturer, and he was a little bit uncomfortable with it. So he wanted a therapist.
And I don't want to make light of the situation. That kind of reminds me of The Sopranos, because one of the plot lines there is that Tony Soprano is in therapy whilst also being a cold-blooded killer and criminal. And in one sense, it makes perfect sense that a torturer would need therapy. But then it's kind of extraordinary in another sense to think that the person is an active torturer and looking for help at the time to what, like any other person who's got professional problems to help cope with the challenges of his
work. Some people who are, for example, social workers, and they are facing so many difficult situations. There's not the cause. They said, I need support for my trauma. But for him is, I'm in a system. I feel the trauma. Can you help me? And this is what I said, no, I cannot do that. I cannot do that. Despite of any technique can help that person to feel okay and to justify that behavior.
Mm-hmm.
No, and this is another story I'd like to share, because this is key in our behavior. But in that case, I say, well, I'd like to help you, because if he sees my face or my heart that is, I'm against that, I could disappear just 5 minutes after.
So this is a very dangerous client.
It's dangerous. It's at the line of life or death. So I said to him, I'd like to help you, but I have very few appointments, and these are my fees. And if he couldn't pay the fees, you know, I knew. You know? So I said, would you refer me to anyone else? I said, no, but I think your contacts will be enough to find somebody.
So you had to find a safe way of refusing to treat him without getting disappeared.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And he was a friend, you know, because he was referred to me by people from churches. You know?
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. It was very intrinsic in the place. But I think the thing that I still have it in my mind, and I was in a hospital around 2 or 3 in the morning, and the children were brought into with a lot of damage. And I said, what happened? And they said, well, we went to the revolutionary's house, and they put the children in the window to protect themselves. So they were wounds by a grenade. So it was very bad. So it was terrible just to deal with the children. In that case, one survived, the other one didn't survive. And it was terrible. But that story that putting the children in the window is staying in my mind. So I went to talk to my friends that they were revolutionaries. And I was at the edge of got into that, but I didn't. Well, for two basic reasons. I didn't go into the revolution, but ideologically I was there. So I said to them, look at what happened. And they said, of course, it makes sense. Because if the military takes our children, first they will kill us, no? They will take our children and they will indoctrinate them with their philosophy, ideology. But if they died, it will be very, very sad. It was terribly sad. But we are young and we can have other children. And our belief, our ideology, our revolution, the word revolution is very important, will survive. So when I heard that, I said, wow. And then I knew that many mothers were with bombs under the prams with the baby, you know, putting these. And fair enough, everything is, what they say, valid in war. No, it was a civil war. But then I went to my father and my professors and I said, look at what happened. And my father said, it makes sense, he says, because ideology is stronger than instinct. And that was for me like, how can this be? What can we do about that? So it was transcendent. I didn't know what to do at that moment. But I still haven't, my father's sign. And my professor echoed that. No? Ideology is stronger than instinct.
That really is extraordinary, Carlos. So I have to replay this just to make sure I understand what's going on. So two children coming to the hospital with horrific injuries, and you're told that their parents held them up in front of the window as effectively human shields as the military engaged them in some kind of operation. And then you put this to a bunch of people who are sympathetic with the revolutionaries, i.e. the parents of the children, and they all justify it.
It was a very rational explanation. I wouldn't like the word justified. They were justified. I will use the word they have an explanation, a rational.
They rationalize it.
It was a rational, but I didn't want to have a rationalization either. I wanted to say they have a narrative and a rational and response to that situation.
So perhaps it's more a case of they're saying, yes, I can understand the logic.
Absolutely. This is what I'm saying. I'm not judging the logic. I'm explaining that it's a logic. But the military, too, they knew that they were children.
Yes,
and they attacked anyway. So their ideology, too, was bigger, no, than having children there. And I remember jeeps coming in with five or six or ten revolutionaries dead and chuck it into the morgue in the hospital. And they leaving, all the soldiers singing, no, about our country and let's clean up the country from this dirt and things like that. Very happy. Happy is the right word. Motivated to get more of these people. And all of that is about ideology.
So that one experience you had with the children is quite stunning, really, because it just shows that on both sides of this conflict, ideologically driven conflict, both sides are able to not only rationalize, but they're both willing to kill children in the name of their ideological cause, which really speaks to your point, the strength of ideology. Would you say the strength of ideology in a way to overcome morality, to enable people to do things? I mean both, you know, injuring gruesomely and killing children in order to get to revolutionaries and allowing your kids to be murdered in order to defend you are quintessentially immoral acts. Like that, for most people, I think would struggle to either kill a child or use their own child or any child and sacrifice their life to defend yourself. Most parents would want to do the opposite. And so it sounds like a fundamental perversion of morality here.
And, yeah, but
and is that... It just shows that it's not so much the details of the ideology.
No, there's no two things. One is, as we speak, this is happening now in the world.
Yes, indeed.
As we speak, you know, I'm talking about history, but I'm talking with a sense of presence. Now, as we speak, there are people justifying that and also justifying that of selling the child for money, for prostitution, not only in an ideology. You know, they become cultures. Not that we are in a culture. the human culture, I mean, not Australian, human culture, that we do those things. It's like what we do. So if we talk about them, it's something that we will never be able to do anything. But if I start thinking that I am in my DNA, I am the revolutionary that put the child there, and I also am the military that shoot them, that I am the father or the mother who sells the child, you know, for a plate of rice, you know, I am that father. That I'm also the corrupt person that goes and pays for that, knowing what it is. It's not an accident. And that I also that little boy or girl who is abused. So we are that. But ideology is what kills ideas. No, the idea is what humans have to be able to relate, to talk, to discover each other. No, Martin Buber talks about I and thou. And so where the I meets the thou, the different, and they sometimes with difficulty try to engage in this conversation, the I and the thou. But we live in a society that is more I only am with those who think like me. And what sad it is when I cannot even do that, that the other become an it. This is Martin Buber, not me. So when the other become an it, a thing, anything could happen. And when the idea can dance, no, among humans, but when that become an ideology, that become very, very scary.
So Carlos, I mean, I can't imagine having these experiences myself, but I do want to ask, in this period of your life in Argentina, witnessing so many horrible things in your as a doctor and also as a therapist later, how are you coping? And what impact is this having on you?
I think what I'm sharing with you, and when you said to her, it's hard for me to imagine, no, something like this, I would like to say to you, try to imagine it. No, try to imagine it. When you look at the news about Myanmar or whatever country, or the abuses that happened before, or happened in Africa, when we see what happened in Congo, what is happening now, we've been working with refugees and see their stories of abuse. I think it's so hard that we say, oh, that's terrible, and they will go next. No, they have a beer and watch cricket or something. I'd like to invite you, you know, stay there for a little bit longer. Now I say, wow, what is to be that man? I'm talking a story from Congo. No, that the man, I'm sorry for being so brutal, but it's what it is. No, this man told us the story not long ago over the phone, said the military come and they rape our wives. The paramilitary come, pass through the town and rape our wives. And sometimes they use the husband as a pillow while they're raping the wife. So it's gruesome. So when I was hearing that, and my daughter was on the phone too, she said, oh my God. You know, and she said, don't tell that story, Dad. Yes, we have to tell the story. Because that person is me. It's me. You know, I'm all of them. So when we are that, we may be able to grasp a little bit of the possibility of change with that insight. That is not them. It's me. You know. So your question, how do I cope? I cope like this. I cope to this being in face with that part of me but also being in faith to another part, that is the one that cry and screams against that, and to be aware of that. And in Argentina, I had the privilege to go into people who were in the liberation theology, to have another context, and we learn a lot about Bonhoeffer, that was a pillar of faith, not of ideology, but of ideas. No, in Germany, that sadly he ended, hanged, I think a few days before the end of the war. So this is where I cope and continue coping, trying to make sense, going to the neuroscience and going to theology, to philosophy, to see who are we? What are we doing? How can we do better? This is how I cope.
It sounds like the experiences you had, particularly during your military service, in a way shaped your research interests.
Absolutely.
And a lifelong journey to try and understand, to put it in very casual layman terms, what makes humans tick.
Absolutely. No. And why I'm in Australia, your question is, I think I'm in Australia because I'm weak. Because I couldn't cope with that. No, many of my friends were able to stay in Argentina and to cope with that. But the amount of my response to that was making me crazy. Many people said I'm crazy anyway, but crazier. But my therapist, who knew me very well and loved me very much, he said to me one day, Carlos, what are you going to do? Because I'll tell you the story, even though people say, don't tell that story because it's terrible. But I would do it to tell it, to show who we are, what I am, no, we are. No, my hate to the military was so high, so high, that, or anything in uniform, that I was one day in my office in the first floor and I saw a policeman walking, a policeman, the more peaceful person in that moment without any power. And I saw a rock that I have on my room, on my floor, as a decoration from the colonial times. And I imagined myself holding the rock, throwing it to him, killing him, and the pleasure. When I saw that in me, I said, wow. So I went to therapy and I shared the story. Not happy, but not even ashamed. This is the sad thing, but scared. I was not ashamed, I was scared. No, and the therapist said, Carlos, what are you going to do? If you continue here with all the therapy you have, all the philosophy you're studying, all the theologians that you're talking to, I'm talking about people related to John Stott and all of that, if you can, whatever you're doing, you cannot control that. You're going to end in jail. You're going to end in the cemetery or in a mental hospital. And she was right. She was right. So why I'm here is because I'm weak. I couldn't stay there. I couldn't turn that around. And I had to go. I had to go.
I've got to say, Carlos, it sounds to me actually like an act of strength rather than weakness.
I don't know.
You sort of stared into the abyss of a kind of feeling that I agree we're all capable of if subjected to the right experiences. You know, almost, if you like, a desire or lust to kill.
Absolutely. But to be, if I'm honest with myself, even though moving to Australia. When I arrived to Australia, I remember 20th June 1986. When I came into Australia, I felt that I lived all my life in the exile and I came home. It was a very profound, weird feeling. But a little bit in my heart, I feel, not often, but sometimes, that I escape from that without helping the people. You know what I mean? It's not very strong, but it's there. It is. This is what I say, weak in that sense.
A kind of survivor's guilt that you got out and
exactly.
You got a better life.
Exactly. And now I'm in contact with them. And Argentina is a mess. It's a total mess. And when I hear them, I say, oh my God, they're my friends, my family. And Argentina is nothing compared with other part of the world. No?
So, Carlos, what are some of the... I'm interested in some of the insights you have. You've kind of raised some and started to go there, but I'd like to pursue them in a bit more depth. You've had this long study of the human condition. You've worked in psychotherapy, psychiatry. You've studied philosophy and theology, all in aid of making sense of your experience, which is a microcosm of a larger experience, as you note, not a historical experience. It's a part of the human condition that is very present, and you only need to turn the news on and see the suffering of the world, a kind of suffering that is too much for most people, which is why they just change the channel and move on, which is an easy thing to do when you live in a country like Australia. What in that process of trying to make sense, that process of discovery, of learning, of insight, of knowledge, where have you arrived in terms of that question of what makes humans tick?
I think I'm in a journey that I will never arrive, first of all. By looking at what you're saying, this is immoral, I use two terms that they are synonymous. So I give the semantics of that, and I don't know if this is right or wrong, but I use that as a metaphor. I use the word ethics to talk about a behavioral, innate, absolute ways of relating that is in our nature. Now, animal nature, but especially our human nature. No, there is a code there that is a determination of what is life-giving or life-draining or life-killing. Note that in the Christian background, we call it the image of God. No, there is a sense of basic consciousness, even though nobody knows what consciousness is. No, but it's a type of consciousness that we have it innate in us, that is there, who allows us to distinguish what is life and death. Now, in the Bible, God said to Moses, you have in front of you life and death, choose life. So it seems that this is intrinsic in the brain. In some subcortical systems, not in the cortical, but the subcortical systems, that it looks like maybe in an area that is called the precuneus, no? An area very little known. So that stays there. Then there is another thing that we learned, and we call that morals. So one is ethics, and the other is morals. So the morality we create, we have a universal ethics, but you have the Spanish morals, the English, the Irish, the Scottish, you know what I mean? The Serbian, the Croatian. So this is where the tension is.
There's a cultural difference, in other words.
As a cultural difference, this is more cortical. And this is learned. This is learned. So this is where I learned what is right or wrong in my culture, not to humanity. This is what I learned. No, the discrimination of another races. This is where I see the color on another person instead of seeing the humanity. This is where I see the level of education and cliques in me. That part of the brain, it looks like that is the part of the insula. No, part of the insula. So the part of the insula is the part that we learn what is right and wrong in my culture. And this is what is very easy to train. And this is where the ideology sits. So if I grew up with an ideology you know, so the common now in this country with the Protestant and Catholics. If you grew up with that, and on top of that, you have history of my parents or my family being murdered by them, and both have the same story, no? Can you imagine now in the Middle East, no? Palestinian and Jews. It's happened as we speak, all of this. So we are living on this moral setting because we don't stop enough, or we don't have the tools to be able to pause and say, what is called insight? What am I doing? And to allow the information from the precuneus or the other part of the brain that we don't know where they are anyway, to be able to inform us. And the method I developed, this is the intention. To go to part of the brain, it's called the play of life, go to part of the brain that may inform me about universal behaviors that could be different, not to what I'm doing. I don't know if I'm talking too much or if it makes sense what I'm saying, but that tension is the tension that we live in.
I do want to just push on the neuroscience a bit, but before that, an interesting question arises here, and you're the right person to put it to, I think, because you've got this combination of personal experience, but also scientific training and knowledge. And I think I know the answer to this, but I just, for the sake of drawing it really out into the surface, because this is an age-old question. You know, do we all have the capacity to do real evil? And I'm conscious here of the Christian theological doctrine in the background of original sin, the fall of creation. You know, no person is without blemish. But I'm talking about torture, murder, killing children, that level, genocide. Now, clearly, no one can contest that some humans are capable of this, and quite a lot when you look across history. I mean, how many people did it take to execute the genocide? Like thousands the Holocaust. You know, it wasn't five Germans. It was thousands and thousands of Germans. And what a lot of people don't realize is, you know, I watched an incredible documentary about the SS units that went into Eastern Europe. And they rounded up local militia to do the killing of their neighbors, the Jews. So you had Latvians killing Latvian Jews, and you had Ukrainians killing Ukrainian Jews. So across many...
And Christian, killing Christians.
Yeah. But it's interesting you mentioned the... I mean, I shouldn't laugh, but it's kind of surreal, the torturer who's coming in for therapy, because one thing I've really noticed from a lot of these stories, which actually shows that the killing does have an immediate effect on people's consciousnesses and probably souls, if you believe in the sort of Christian language of souls. Because what I observed is that these groups they set up in the Baltic states and Eastern Europe, I mean, it took this is before the sort of systematic industrial slaughter of Jews and gypsies and homosexuals using the gas chambers. And so it's quite a resource-intensive genocide. They have to round up local Jews, line them up, shoot them, and bury them. So these local militia are spending day after day in each town just killing in a very sort of personal way by shooting dead. And they very quickly became drunk permanently, which clearly says to me that they were looking to escape the very thing that they were prepared to do. So anyway, that's a slight deviation. To come back to the question I was going to ask is it your view that any one of us could be that drunk killer, just executing man, woman, and child after man, woman, and child in the name of some crazy, perverted ideology?
Well, my first answer is, I don't know, but I think it was Abraham Heschel who says, only few are guilty. And I forgot if he said, but many are responsible, or he said, but we are all responsible. I forgot. It doesn't matter. All I prefer, we are all responsible. So the question of the guilt, capable or capability, theoretically, we are all capable. And as I mentioned to you, through ideology and not a lot of work. Now, I'm a psychodramatist, that you work with drama and role training. There are roles that you can very dumb. There are feelings that you can dumb within you and you become totally insensitized. And there are roles you can create. So theoretically, everybody can. Something I say, oh, I will never do that. Okay, we'll accept that. But following Heschel, now Abraham Heschel, by the way, was one of the mentors of Martin Luther King Jr. And was an amazing Jew, that reading him about God is a delight. You know? And if we follow him, the only few may be guilty or they are guilty. But what is my level of responsibility? Maybe that may not be all ready to torture, but I can assure you that we are all ready to be quiet. Who is more responsible is an issue of reflection. I don't have an answer. I don't have an answer. This is what I was saying to you. I invite you, when you see the news, to pause. Is there anything we can do? So in Judaism, we talk about prayer, not coming from a Christian background. You pray. You pray for the people there, you pray for the people over there, and you pray, not that God act. But in Judaism, there is a word, it's called tefillah. Tefillah is prayer, but also it's a communion with God, saying, what can I do with you, God, to act on that? So we're talking about in Australia, we have two major social issues. Now, one is the Indigenous situation, especially now coming closer to Australia Day. And we have the refugee, apart from many others, disabilities and all of that. No? So in that case, now, what is my prayer? Oh, God, bless these people in Manus Island or whatever. But the tefillah is to stay a little bit longer. May not be too long. A little bit longer to the wonder, what can I do? And to allow this to come and to be able to act. And this is what friends comes on board. How do we talk to others about that? Where communities, church becomes institutions, what are we doing? So the I and the us and the we becomes relevant. So this is where I'm working in wonder. Coming back again to the question of, can we do that? One day they said it was a rabbi, I forgot the story, I lost it. They was visiting the Auschwitz with a group of Jews from Israel. And everybody shocked. All of them had somebody in their family who died there. And the rabbi says, it could have been worse. And people say, how can this be worse than this? And he said, they could have been us. I said, wow. So for me to recognize inside me that I could have done that, but only by grace I'm not doing it, is important. So can I do it? I don't know. But I can be silent and accomplice, yes, I can.
I think if most of us are being honest, and I want to just bring in the Argentinian case study here, I find it hard to imagine myself killing children and torturing, which is not to say I couldn't do it, but I can't imagine myself doing that. But I can be very honest and say, not only can I imagine myself being quiet, I'm almost certain I would be. And I think everyone listening could put themselves in the position of the Argentinian people, just one people that have experienced political violence and oppression, and realize that if the butcher and the music teacher are randomly disappearing and the regime is prosecuting a vicious war with revolutionaries and there are checkpoints all over, there's a very visible presence of the military, they're surveilling and disciplining the universities, and I suppose no one in the country is unaware that torture is going on because people are disappearing and some of them are probably coming back worse for wear. It's not hard to imagine that the fear and the terror would cower most of us if in that situation. If this were to happen in Australia, sure, there would be some brave martyrs that would stand up. And I personally, I would be very reticent to call those people cowards, because I think unless you've been, like you, that first extraordinary story you told about the people coming into the university lecture hall, I mean, it would be not only brave, but perhaps foolishly brave if one of those students stood up and challenged five guys with machine guns.
It wouldn't be pretty.
So like I say, I think we can look with great admiration on those who have extreme courage in these situations. I'm not sure. I think we need to be cautious in condemning.
Well, I tell you, there is a name. There is a name. I don't call these people cowards. I call them callous. There is a name for that. There is a name for the killer. There is a name for the silent, and there is a name for the victim.
So I think when your government is terrorizing its people, then all those who are silent are actually victims too.
Absolutely. This is what I'm saying.
It's not like they're just living a great life.
No.
They're terrified. They're afraid that they might be the next one to disappear. And so really, that's probably the best way to look on governments, particularly repressive and oppressive governments, whether they're left, right, green, red, up, down, triangle, circle. When you're repressing and oppressing your people, you're victimizing everyone in a way, including the soldiers and the intelligence services, because you're forcing them as well to do.
It's the whole issue about institutional leadership, no? How institutions of any line or level are leading, no, towards life or death. Ultimately, I'm not dualistic, but the brain is binary. No? The brain is on and off. The brain is extremely simple, like a computer, on and off. And from that, the complexity emerges. No? This is for another conversation, how the brain works. No? But ultimately, is to be able to allow myself, come back to what I said to you, to pause when something like that happened. I say, how I'm resonating with that. That has a name. It's called limbic resonance. With that, it's happening and it's fantastic. Am I enjoying with that in a way that I'm in joy with them? And my heart, my man blossoms, knowing God in this ecstasy. What a beautiful thing. But also when I'm facing the other, how much I allow myself to be able to be there with the question of tefila. What am I going to do about that? So this is my wonder. I have more questions than answers. No, but this is my wonder.
So just back, I would like to finish actually with a theological question. But one other question on the way. I flagged that I wanted to come back to the neuroscience, because what I understood from what you're saying, which is absolutely fascinating, is that it's possible to pinpoint a location in the brain where what you've described with my help as cultural morality or culturally informed or inflected morality sits, and you articulated that morality is learned, and we can all understand how you learn it because we all grow up in a culture. We're all enculturated animals, whatever else we are, creatures. So that obviously then means that it can be unlearned or relearned. But obviously the formative period where morality is set, I imagine, is in the family and the school in the first instance. And I guess to an extent the wider cultural context or milieu, which depending on the political culture might be a greater or lesser influence. You know, if you're going to school and you're being taught, that's funny, my wife who went to school in Athens in the 80s, so she's a lot younger, was still taught anti-Italian songs that went all the way back to World War II when the Greeks fought the Italians and won. And she can still sing this amazing sort of funny song in Greek ridiculing Mussolini. And she was taught that they would sing that song at school. So, you know, even in Greece, she had a much more nationalistic education, ideological.
This is what I'm saying. You know, can you imagine at that time?
Yeah.
That an Italian child came to the town or to the school.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. That's right. That's right. It'd be worse if they were Turkish. I mean, I read an interesting study by a Greek scholar looking at the way Turks are presented in Greek high school and the way Greeks are presented in Turkish high school. And they're identical.
That's funny.
And both of them are demonized. And so both sides, you can see how the education kind of reinforces this conflict because you enter adulthood in both those education systems with a kind of inbuilt suspicion. And it's not all fantasy. There are there's a lot of historical baggage between those two nations. And it's replayed right now where there's always a sort of tension and a slight risk of war between those two NATO allies, which is a whole other paradox that we don't need to get into. But what I want to ask you about is, given this neuroscience knowledge and given the formative influence of schooling, family, and the wider culture, apart from therapy and miraculous conversions in isolated individual cases, how can you shift that needle when you're talking about large populations of people? How does a country like Argentina get out of its polarized, highly ideological, sometimes violent political culture, if that's what every young Argentinian grows up in?
I'd like to say, if I have an answer, I may not be talking to you here. We may be together. We may be together in other places in the world resolving the problems.
Okay. Of course. I appreciate it. Sir.
I know.
It's impossible.
I'm playing with the idea. When you were talking, it came to my mind a few things. Sorry if I go to other places, but this is how my mind works. That sometimes I don't know how it works anyway. When you're talking like that, there's a story. The first story in the Bible is a narrative that Adam was placed in this garden and said, don't eat the fruit with your wife, and he ate the fruit. Okay? Then God comes and he says, Adam, where are you? No? It's an existential question. Where are you? So Adam come back and he says, I heard you in the garden and I was afraid. Okay, good then. And then God says, what happened? Look at the mess you made. What happened? What did Adam did? Did he collapse in tears and say, I'm so sorry, I messed it up? No. He looked at God's eyes. Of course, it's a narrative, a myth. God's eyes and says, The woman you gave me made me do it. This is the story of humanity. Not soon after, there are two brothers. One killed the other one. And God said, "Where is your brother?" What did he answer? They said, "I don't know. Am I the carer of my brother?" So this is the stories that there is in a narrative. That is a story that we need to answer. When somebody asks me, or that voice, no, I don't call it God, call it a voice, ask me, "Carlos, where are you? What do I do with that?" So we need to know that fear is the first response we have to any situation. This is why it's something that we don't have time to talk about. It's called the Enneagram that we work, and Melanie, my daughter, works on that. That is based on that. What is my fear and where do I hide? So you're talking, say, what to do? This is what we need to do. When I hear, where am I? Be aware of my fear and find a way to stay there and not to hide. Because we hide through our behaviors. We hide through our thoughts. We hide behind our ideologies. To start hiding. Easy to say, difficult to do. The second one is, the mind creates a construct that is called a cognitive bias that we all have. So when somebody asks you, "How are you?" the fear comes up. But what did you do? Automatically, there is a cognitive bias that was not me. That was not me. So you're questioning, what can we do? So I'm trying to respond in that way. Where are you? Instead of saying, "I know where I am," to answer, "I don't know. I don't know." And that opens the possibility of seeking. No? Seek and you will find. I'm scared. I don't know what to do to stay there. Secondly, to know that my construct is a barrier I'm creating, and to stay longer in the "I don't know." And in that moment, I may need to have somebody with me, a companion, a friend, a therapist, spiritual director, or a good buddy, no? To stay there and to stay in that quandrum, in that space. And the other one is to know that, yes, I'm the carer of my brother. And the first one is called insight. Insight. And the other one is, yes, I'm the carer. What can I do? That is a call to action. And as a Christian, a Judeo-Christian, I believe that in the tradition, we have a concept of Christ that allows us to start thinking about that. To be able to stay there, and there is a word in Judaism, it's called teshuvah. Teshuvah is forgiveness. It's to, wow, this is what I've done. But what is teshuvah? Teshuvah is to return. Return to where I am. What is my being? And to be able to do that. So inside, yes, this is my brother. To have a companion or somebody. This is the method we are designing, the aim to do that. Hopefully to fast track inside. To do that and to be able to visualize a possibility. Sadly, religion blocks that insight. You know, one person said, "God has spoken, let's make a tower." No? The tower is so precious and sacred, let's make a wall around, a fence around to protect it. Let's pray to the fence. So our concept of majesty, a concept of wonder is so far away that it is possible through this process to be able to wonder and to stay there. I don't know if my answer helped in any way, but this is my mumbling in my mind.
Well, if that's your mumbling, you've got a good mind. Because most of, we can't all mumble that well. Let me finish here, Carlos, and it really segues beautifully from what you just said. In a way, it's a theological question, and I want to ask you about theodicy. But this is also an opportunity to explain, to talk about. It's a way of finishing on a positive note, because you have recounted some harrowing experiences, and part of me feels guilty for forcing you to go to parts of your life you'd probably prefer to forget. But I think people will benefit from the honest look that there are humans that experience suffering firsthand. But you are a man of faith. I take it you were a man of faith even while you were having these experiences we discussed in Argentina. You strike me as someone who went through some awful, witnessed some awful things that would challenge anyone's faith. And I'm sure there's lots of stories of people that have lost their faith for less than the kind of appalling violence or the effects of appalling violence that you witnessed, not to mention the sort of depressing political environment that you lived in. And yet it sparked a journey of discovery, looking for answers. And one of the places you went was to deepen your faith, to study God, to study the Christian and Jewish tradition and the scriptures. And I'm sure every listener can share with me, listening to you talk, you're a person of light. You're a person who, you know, in a way, the light of your faith shines through, which is a remarkable place to end up after the darkness that you experienced. But I wonder, what would you say, particularly to an atheist who says, well, how can you possibly believe in this God all these years later? Not just experiencing what you experienced in Argentina, but you yourself have referred to even worse cases. We've talked about the Holocaust, and in more recent times, what's happened in the Democratic Republic of Congo. You only need to look at Syria. There are far too many examples. You want political repression? Look at North Korea. Why do you believe in God?
Oh, you're putting me in a very difficult place.
I mean, I'm not. It can be a personal answer. It doesn't have to be.
I think it's the right answer. First of all, I have never found an atheist in my life. And I read Richard Dawkins a lot. He's not an atheist. He's an anti-Christian, as Jonathan Sacks in the interview with him. He said, Jonathan Sacks to Richard Dawkins, if you in YouTube is the interview, fantastic, fantastic debate, respectful. And Sacks said, Andrew, you are a Christian atheist. And Dawkins said, what are you talking about? So it was a good response. So I don't believe that Bertrand Russell is an atheist. I don't believe that Dawkins is an atheist. I don't believe that Daniel Dennett is an atheist. There are absolutely anti manipulation of faith. I don't know what I'm saying is right or wrong, but anti manipulation of faith, an anthropomorphism of a God that is pathetic. They're against that. The way they do it may be right, wrong, aggressive or not, it doesn't matter. But I think if we stop in the way that I was talking about, where are you? We talk about that and we look at meaning and existence of us with also the sense of I'm my brother's carer. And we have a conversation about that. We are going to stimulate ourself and our image of God in us, call it whatever. With a Christian and a Jew and a Richard Dawkins or Sam Harris or anyone who are the, or Christopher Hitchens, if he come back to life, it will be an amazing encounter. But they will be not talking about religion. They will talk in an essence of behavior that in my belief is in Christ. Is in Christ. No, in a Jesus life that has been hidden and shadowed by traditional things that defends. Again, I can say whatever because I'm not a theologian. If I'm a theologian, I may not be able to say all of these things. But I believe that there is the possibility of an encounter if, only if, I can see the other as the other, and not just to put it as I and I, and struggle with this, and not to put him as an it. I think we have the opportunity to be like that with ourselves first and our thoughts, not to be too scared of our thoughts, no fear. But how we spend the time with our friends, our family, our wives, husbands, with the children. Is there a space to play? Play is important. To play as an I and thou. This is where I'm still a believer. Because I think it is possible. And I still believe that the kingdom of God is within us. And it's close. I don't know if that answers your question. Sorry for being so long.
No, this is a long form conversation format. So the whole point is to go long. Carlos, I think that's a great note to finish on. And I really just want to thank you and share my appreciation with you for taking the time to talk about your own personal life and through it to share many, many insights about the human condition and some really thought-provoking things that I'm sure listeners will take away with them to think about themselves, where they are, who they are, where they stand, and what kind of responsibility we have in the world that does, for better or worse, and we can't ignore it, involve still a lot of suffering. So thank you so much.
I'd like to say thank you to you because you're an excellent nudger. You're nudging me for answers. You're an excellent companion, respectful inquirer. No, and I feel that this was just a conversation, and people who knows me, I say, oh, Carlo will talk like this after dinner too, you know, because this is where I am. So I really appreciate your capacity, your skill that you allowed me to be me. And I felt that you treated me as a thou. And I hope I did the same with you, no, like an I and thou.
Most definitely. It was a very rewarding experience to walk alongside you through these topics, and I trust listeners as well, because the whole point of a podcast is you allow them to participate in the conversation and a walk that they otherwise might not have had the opportunity to. And I'm very confident that they have benefited from this particular journey. So
I don't know if that is appropriate, no, but if people who are maybe listening to this and like to be in touch and to wander together, it will be an interesting point of reference to. I don't know how appropriate is that or not.
Well, I can put, I'll put some details in the show notes where people can find you if they would like to continue the conversation. That sounds like an invite there. Okay, with all of that self-congratulatory backslapping, we'll sign off. Thanks to everyone for listening. See you next time.